As humans and technology advance, our footprint on the world's ecosystem is as drastic as it's ever been. With large populated cities all over the world making changes to the wildlife around it, it's important to look at what effect our urban areas have on the plants and animals within them. But what if these cities and urban dangers don't hurt the animals, but force them to evolve to fit into this new world? Menno Schildhausen, a senior research scientist at the Naturalist Biodiversity Center in the Netherlands, has been studying the exponential evolution of city animals. In his new book, Darwin Comes to Town, How the Urban Jungle Drives Evolution, Schildhausen attempts to answer the question, are species evolving to fit around us? It's published by Picador and it's available now, and I'm so glad it brings Menno Schildhausen to the show. Welcome.
Thank you.
So first, how does one become inspired to write about this particular subject?
I guess it has to do with the fact that you can, in cities, and as animals and plants in cities are adapting, evolutionarily adapting to a city environment, you can actually watch evolution taking place literally in your backyard. And it's taking place much faster than people think, because we tend to think of evolution as a very slow process that takes thousands, millions of years to see, and yet some of these processes take place in a time span of years or decades.
The title, of course, comes from Darwin, Charles Darwin, who, when speaking of evolution, said, "We see nothing of these slow changes in progress until the hand of time has marked the long lapse of ages." Is this true?
Well, it turns out that it's not always true. I think Darwin was—he underestimated the power of the process that he himself had discovered. He couldn't imagine that it's something that you can actually watch happening, watch taking place in a human lifespan. And it turns out, over the past 50 years, I guess, more and more examples have been found of evolutionary change taking place in time spans of years or decades. And it has to do with the fact that sometimes the advantage of being different is so great, and the generation time is so short. Like, many insects have multiple generations per year, and generation time is sort of the evolutionary clock speed. So at every generation, you can see the effects of the natural selection that took place in the previous generation. So if you have multiple generations per year, evolution can also take place very fast.
We use the word evolution a lot now.
Yeah.
You know, we throw it around to mean different things. But in this context, how would you best define evolution?
It's the change in, let's say, proportions of genetic characteristics over time. So it does not necessarily mean that you need to get a new species. Simply, if a species changes its appearance a little bit from one generation to the next, that's already evolution. And those changes accumulate to having completely new species. And that's normally what we think of as evolution. But it really is made up of all these small steps.
Are species still evolving slowly enough that one person could notice in their lifetime?
Yes, they're evolving fast enough so that people can notice in their lifetime. For example, we're watching in the Netherlands. We're doing a project on grove snails, which is a common land snail that also occurs in North America as an introduced species, and we can watch the shell color of those snails evolving in cities over the time span of 20 or 30 years, as these urban heat islands produce more heat and the lighter colored snails are better protected.
Okay,
against
I need you to say that. We're watching snail shells mm-hmm. over a course of time. So,
yeah.
Over 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, so it's a bit ironic that a snail has very fast fast evolution.
20, 30 years is considered fast.
It's considered fast, yeah, because as Darwin said, that we thought that it needed much longer than that. And we can actually see the shells becoming lighter colored because the light-colored snails are better protected against overheating. They reflect the sun's rays better, and in cities it gets much hotter than outside of cities.
So in Darwin Comes to Town, what are some of the species that you are looking at?
Oh, many examples. One of my favorite examples is the city pigeon, which of course is the best known city animal that you can think of. The rats, rats of the sky. And they're also evolving. They're exposed to a lot of heavy metals in cities. There's a lot of zinc and lead and other heavy metals around that they ingest, which is not good for them. And it turns out that the darker city pigeons, the ones with these dark gray plumage, are better protected against the toxicity of those heavy metals, and that's because they put it in their feathers. The melanin in the feathers binds to these heavy metals, so it helps these city pigeons to detox, as it were. So that's why in cities you find darker city pigeons than outside of cities, and that's real urban evolution that you can see on the streets of New York.
How did you start to notice that species were adapting to their surroundings, like pigeons?
I guess it's something that from the 1950s, 1960s, people have slowly started noticing, not only in cities, but also outside of cities, even in famous places like the Galapagos, which are, of course, they're actually urban nowadays, but at the time they weren't urban. And people have started looking at animals and plants that you can observe in the field. You can actually measure them. And that's Darwin and his contemporaries didn't do that. They didn't actually measure the shape of a beak of a finch. And people have started doing that in the 1960s and really showing that from one generation to the next, you can see those beaks and seed sizes and colors and all kinds of measurable things of wild animals and plants change from one generation to the next. And in cities where the pressure is really on to change and to adapt to these extreme conditions, this kind of evolution is taking place even faster.
I'm speaking with evolutionary biologist Menno Skilthausen about his latest book, Darwin Comes to Town, How the Urban Jungle Drives Evolution. So let's talk about New York City. Have you noticed specific changes here and pigeons or other species here in New York?
Well, there's a very good example of work that's done here in New York City by a colleague of mine, Jason Munshi South of Fordham University. He's studying the white-footed mice in city parks in New York. This is not, you know, the domestic mouse. It's a real wild species of mouse that used to occur all over North America in natural habitats. Also in the forest that was here before Manhattan was and the five boroughs were built. But now they're surviving marooned in bits of forest, namely city parks, all over the city. And Jason is studying the genetics, real the DNA of these mice, and he's showing that in every park they're adapting to the local conditions. And those local conditions can be very different. Central Park, for example, is visited by 25 million people per year, and they drop junk food and snacks and candy, and that's what these mice are feeding on. So he's actually showing that in the chromosomes of these mice, genes are appearing that help them survive better on a high-fat diet. So they're really adapting to human foods, human diets. And that's happening in a wild mouse, and it's different from other parks where there's less pressure from junk food that's thrown around.
Not to, you know, prioritize humans over animals, but what do we do with this information?
Well, I think first of all, it's important to realize that we're really shaping the urban ecosystem. And as cities expand and are taking up a larger proportion of the Earth's surface, it's really going to be an important habitat, whether we like it or not. Cities are going to be a place where a lot of wild animals and plants are surviving. They're going to be the ecosystems that we as humans interact with mostly. So it's important to realize that those food webs, those ecosystems in cities are evolving and are adapting to us. And also that we can perhaps change our cities in such a way that we can help this process. We can help these mature and healthy urban ecosystems to evolve, because whether we like it or not, we're part of those ecosystems.
And so how do we do that? How do we help them evolve and how do we not help them?
Well, I think one of the things we can do, for example, is when we're building green spaces, and of course that's a big thing nowadays in city planning, people like to have green roofs and green walls and urban greening, but we tend to stock those places with just plants from the garden center. And these are not necessarily plants that are well adapted to an urban environment. I would rather say just leave them empty and let them colonize naturally by plants that are already in the city and are already evolving to adapt to an urban environment.
Right, because if we're making those spaces, we're making them. They're not evolving, right?
Yeah.
That's not a natural evolution.
Exactly. We're creating ecosystems by planting species, but it would be much more efficient to let the urban wildlife and flora to colonize those spaces, those places by themselves.
Are there any cities that actually do that?
Not cities, but there are some initiatives of companies that provide, for example, street tiles, which already have a little pocket saved, a little depression that can fill with soil naturally and can be colonized by weeds and other plants naturally. So there are some small scale initiatives, but not really on the big scale of parks and green roofs yet. But I hope that will change.
In the book, you state that flora in American cities is 35 to 40% exotic, that meaning there are a lot of plants in cities that you'd never expect. Why is this?
Yeah, that's true all over the world. Especially plants are being carried around by people all the time, so you see a sort of homogenization taking place of the wildlife in cities. So those species of plants and animals that are very good at living in cities, they're also being transported by people. And that's actually a very interesting process, that you have a sort of global urban ecosystem appearing of species that do particularly well in cities and that are being transported by people all over the world. It does mean that in cities, native species are going to be in the minority at some point. But it also means at the same time that we are probably going to see a very healthy, well-functioning ecosystem in cities that's made up of species that come from all over the globe.
And is there such a drastic difference between species in rural farmlands and cities?
More and more. It's in the past, the farmland was rich in species and the city was poor because the cities were basically wildlife unfriendly, whereas farmland was like a small scale mosaic of all kinds of little bits of habitat, little bushes, little ponds. But nowadays, every maximum productivity is being squeezed out of every square inch of farmland, and there's less and less space in agricultural areas for species, wild species, to survive. And at the same time, cities are becoming more biodiversity friendly. We're making small parks, we're making those green roofs and green walls. Think of private urban gardens, each of which is a different kind of habitat because of the preferences of the person who lives there. So cities are becoming richer, and agricultural areas are becoming poorer in biodiversity, unfortunately.
You talk about the tribute in Light 9/11 Memorial and how the spotlights trap songbirds every year. Why does that happen?
That's because songbirds, especially warblers in North America, they migrate in the middle of September from north to south, and the downtown Manhattan is actually a sort of a natural funnel where these migration routes pass, and they migrate at night because at night there are not many sparrowhawks or other dangers. But then they get trapped by the tribute in light, which exactly at that time shines, I think, 81 very bright light beams into the sky, which is a very beautiful ethereal performance, you could say. But at the same time, to these birds, it's very confusing because they get trapped by the light, they get confused, and I'm sure many of them get killed.
Why have they not evolved or learned how to avoid that light?
I think they actually are evolving. It hasn't been studied in birds yet, but it has been studied in insects, which show the same thing, of course. They are also attracted by artificial light at night, and they get killed by that light, or at least they lose time simply by sitting close to light, whereas they should be looking for food or for partners. And some evidence is showing that they're actually insects are evolving in cities to avoid light, or at least not to be attracted as strongly to them as they are in more rural areas. And I'm sure that's going on. That same process is going on in lots of animals and maybe even plants that their physiology is changing because that light at night.
Would you say that when that memorial was built, likely nobody thought about the birds?
Probably not. No. And as people have seen, that birds at that time of the year do get confused by those lights. They have introduce changes, turning the lights off whenever it turns out that a lot of big flocks of birds are trapped by them, to give them time to recover and to fly on again. So it has been dealt with, but I'm sure it's something that nobody expected to happen.
But that is something that you think that moving forward, maybe, you know, architects, people who are building things.
Yeah, I think so. Especially and any large project that people undertake will have some impact on wildlife, and often with something like this that doesn't seem to have a very direct connection with wildlife, it's not something that people think of immediately.
I've been speaking with evolutionary biologist Menno Skilthausen about his latest book, Darwin Comes to Town: How the Urban Jungle Drives Evolution. Tonight at 7, he will be speaking and signing books at the Powerhouse Arena. That's at 28 Adams Street in Brooklyn. Thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thank you.